So I am so excited that I've been doing this podcast for 10 years. This is sort of a 10th year anniversary. And I want to every now and then reel out the evergreen, like as if they're brand new podcasts that have meant so much to me and I learned so much. Nassim Taleb is one of the smartest people on the planet. I've learned so much from this guy. I don't even know if he knows or cares how much I've learned from him. I was so grateful he came on my podcast. There's a little story to it. So he came on my podcast a few years ago, and we're going to have it on now. But there's a story he might not even be aware of. So back in 2002, I wrote to 20 people that I wanted to meet. And I was broke. I was hungry. I was struggling. I was losing my house. I was losing family, everything. And I wrote to 20 people, people like Warren Buffett and Carl Icahn and all these famous investors and writers. And I said, I wanted to meet people. And only 3 people responded. So Jim Cramer responded. I'd written him 10 ideas for articles he should write for thestreet.com. And he responded amazingly and said, hey, these ideas are great. How about you write them? And that started my career as a writer. I started writing financial columns and then expanded out to other stuff. Victor Niederhofer responded because I sent him literally software programs. And I said, I know your trading style. This is for you and your traders. And if you need any help figuring it out, you could respond to me. Otherwise, no pressures. And I wrote to Nassim Taleb and I just, you know, loved his book, Fooled by Randomness. And I wanted to meet him. And I wrote to 17 other people. So 17 people didn't even respond except for Victor, Jim, and Nassim. And Nassim said, oh, he'd be happy to meet. And for some reason, I never responded to Nassim. But then over a decade later, or many, many years later, he came on my podcast and that was full circle and I was so grateful. But anyway, one of the smartest men in the universe, here's Nassim Taleb.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show.
Let's look at technology. Technology
okay.
works beautifully when it destroys bad technology. In Anti-Fragile, I discuss the Lindy effect, which tells you pretty much the following. If something has been around for 20 years, odds are it has 20 more years to go.
Yeah.
So if something's been around, a technology, an idea, that's not perishable. For a human, you don't have that effect. For a right. technology, you have that effect because there's no upper bound on the life of a technology. So if I see an old man and his grandson, I can say statistically that bearing some problem with the grandson, some disease, some whatever problem, that the grandson will survive the grandfather. Whereas with technology, it's exactly the opposite. If you see very young technology and old one, odds are young technology is not going to survive. And the old one simply is a concept, it's application, straight application of the measurement of fragility, the techniques to measure fragility, that time is either breaks what is fragile, right, or gives what has some properties, some hidden properties of survival, gives it some edge, okay? So when we look now at technologies, you realize that technologies tend to stick are technologies that are destructive of other technologies. Because the book has not really been replaced, okay, but
right.
Some things have been replaced. So let's talk about television, all right, where people say, well, there are a lot of social networks, but think about what we had before. You sit in a nuclear family or whatever it's called, used to be called, watching someone giving you propaganda on the screen, all right? Mm-hmm. That's not social life. Whereas now at least you can communicate with other people. That's social network.
So in some sense, we're going back to having a social life because of social media.
Exactly. And then the other thing, think of computers, right? Computers are technology that have been displaced by what? Laptops. But laptops have been displaced by what? Tablets.
Yeah.
How did we start writing?
Yeah, tablets.
All right. So look at what food we have on the table today. Someone in 1960 would have predicted that for dinner tonight, you're going to have Bill and some flying saucer or whatever it is. You get the idea, all right? And effectively, you're going to be eating closer in a presentation, you see, something closer to how your grandparents ate
Right. And well, you mentioned the glass, that we still use a glass, and that was invented like 3,600 years ago.
Exactly. Glass was invented, I mean, it was marketed at least 3,000 plus years ago. And glass has, and all we've done is improve glass.
So what about things that are truly disruptive, though, like a car versus a horse, okay, email versus mail?
The car versus a horse, but the car has been disrupted by the bicycle, which is older.
Right.
So you have, the point is statistical. Someone, when I talk about life expectancy, I'm talking about your life expectancy, I look at an insurance table and I have a number, okay? That number is statistical. It's not deterministic, okay? There'll be mistakes. And I'm sure you're going to live, your life expectancy probably is, you know, as of today, maybe 84, 85, but I'm sure you're going to live 100, right? Mm-hmm. Well, that's not in the table, you know, that you can live longer, but people live 100. Mm-hmm. And some people, unfortunately, have an early termination. So this is statistical. Same thing for technology. Statistically, new technology doesn't stick. And statistically, it's not going to be replaced by old technology so much as by something newer, you see? And typically, the newer will resemble old technology. And if you see the bicycle, it resembles a horse.
I see. So in some sense, email is actually being replaced, right? I see in my daughters, email is being replaced by texting. My daughter doesn't even look at her email anymore.
Well, there we go. And it started before email.
Yeah, and texting started before email.
Started before email. So you have... But you can't look at it on a microscopic level. You've got to look at it at a global, something more global.
Well, global and personal. Because individuals want to be, we strive for anti-fragility.
Yeah, but another comment I'm going to make about how the world will look like in the future is going to project the world is exactly the opposite way someone in 1960, you know, still with their mind full of modernity, would have imagined it. You're going to imagine a table, how we're going to eat in 50 years or 20 years. We're going to be even closer to our ancestors in presentation, probably, but it'll be more efficient.
Yeah,
you see, we will. I was talking about walking. You see, our ancestors walked barefoot, which is very good for your back and stuff like that. And when I go to the park, I see people using five fingers. You see,
right?
So you've used technology to protect yourself from the elements, while at the same time replicating the natural gait. Well, this is how you can generalize that to how we. We actually would like to live. We live in small communities, and effectively, you know, you can build small communities. And the web, in a way, is not alienating us, contrary, you know, to what I myself and everyone I know used to think in the beginning, that the social network is no, the social network would bring us back to, you know, what we were, people communicating with each other.
You see,
going down to an agora and just trading information. That's what we want. We want to give information because somehow information wants to leave it doesn't want to stay in you, you know, it wants to leave you, right?
That's an interesting way to look at it. So, you know, I have a story to tell you. In 2002, I was down on my luck because I had done everything wrong. You know, I was very fragile. I made some money in the 90s, lost it in 2000, 2001. 2002, I wrote out about 40 emails out to people saying, hey, can I grab coffee for you? And three people responded, and I responded to two of the three, and so Jim Cramer responded, Victor Niederhofer responded, and you responded, and unfortunately, I had the wrong coffee.
I don't remember. Because
it's okay.
I had at the time, and I'm trying to implement.
But
it
I wish again. I had responded.
No, but I had a golden rule written in stone, is that you always reply to emails.
What do you do if you get you must get like 5,000 emails a day?
I get maybe 8 or 9 a day.
Oh,
you can verify. I'm going to give you my cell phone. You can verify. Always reply, except when you set the boundaries. So now I have an auto reply. No documentary, no this, no that, no finance discussion, no this, this, this. So someone has a genuine otherwise request. And usually when I take a day off to reply, and during that day, I cover most of the year's backlog in one day, no more than a day, typically when I'm in some hotel room, with jet lag. And I replied to a very insightful professor who wrote me a letter 3 years ago. end up replying.
Those are the best, when you can reply after 3 years.
You can reply. No, because I put it in my, I put a star. It's a longer one, and it elicited more than a quick thanks, John, for the nice words.
Yeah.
It required some kind of reply. So, but please, I mean, I don't want to get be flooded with mail, but that, at the time, I had a dogma, and of course, things went out of control after the Black Swan.
Yeah.
And now... I have a filter. In other words, if you meet some requirements, you know, I'm obligated to answer. Huh. You see, if someone is trying to sell me something or trying to invite me to a TED conference, of course, I don't have to reply. It's part of the, please don't invite, you know. If, journalists, I don't reply to. I don't want journalists in my life, which is the reason, you know, I'm on Twitter.
Yeah.
Or I want minimum amount of journalists in my you know, there's something about the atmosphere when you have journalism in it. It sort of debases it.
Well, I think in general it's what you say. There's not skin in the game, so journalism has to respond to a news cycle where, by almost by definition, they're trying to scare you.
There's something about it that about the system. Okay, because I believe in journalists, the thoughtful ones, the ones who you know, go to Iraq, you know, to report from there and get kidnapped. That's a different class from people sitting in their garage
BuzzFeed,
working for whatever it is and making comments for Bloomberg on the markets, okay?
Yeah.
And telling you market went down a point because and inventing a reason and filling. And in fact, it can be very damaging because the journalist caused the Iraq war. So you're providing noise that causes people to take risks under the illusion of certainty. This is why but there are other things also with journalism. The way I have had my ideas treated by journalists told me why I don't need the middleman. I can go straight.
Right.
You see? So I've been using social media in a very satisfactory way because I go straight, you know, cut the middleman.
You know, cutting the middleman, which has been happening across every industry, is a form of anti-fragility now.
It is definitely because okay, when you wake up in the morning, all right, and you check your mail, if you're scared of getting mail from anyone, this is what I say, sign of robustness, at least. To become anti-fragile, first you have to be robust. Yeah. If you're scared of getting, if you see an email and you're scared, or if you're scared of getting an email, it means you don't have the right life.
That's true.
If you're scared of someone saying something about you on Twitter or something, it means you don't have the right profession, if you're scared. Because eventually, if you're fragile, it's going to break.
Right.
You see? So, and people notice it. So you have to put yourself in a situation where you're no longer scared of that.
Now, let me ask you about that, because my technique for dealing with that is I don't respond at all to anybody saying something negative.
No,
about
I don't care.
My
no,
ideas.
If you really don't care, you don't respond at all. But sometimes you like to mess with a guy.
Right.
Sometimes you like
to
mess
respond.
With people. Not always. When I like to mess with someone.
Okay.
So I have my, recently I've had, because I'm a Christian from the Near East, so I'm waiting to find some of these, what I call them, Arab intellectuals, right? Which are, they are sort of like ambivalent. Yes, we should be this, should be that. And I wanted to dump on someone, all right? And of course, I found a couple of people, and that was fun, okay? But I don't really. Once in a while, okay. For example, if someone bothers me, I have a forum to go and state and keep going at him. And if he doesn't like it, if he doesn't like to be bullied, he shouldn't bully, right? So, but it happens to me, I do it as a form of entertainment more than necessity.
Right.
You see that?
Yes.
It's different. If you do it out of necessity, you're dead.
If you do anything out of necessity, perhaps.
You're dead. Exactly. Anything, if you have to respond to something, you're dead. You see? If you do it just because there's a certain class of people who... political scientists, these people bother me or intellectually, and I like to have some form of entertainment because I'm human, okay? So that's a hobby, and I usually reserve these episodes to when I'm in a restaurant waiting for someone. You see, and you get in a bad mood if someone's late and you're hungry, you see the idea, so it's a perfect time to be aggressive with people. But I've had recently, you know, I had this paper that you have in your hand on precautionary principle, mostly that people talk about GMOs, say, oh, we have no evidence that they're harming. Yeah, but you don't have evidence they're not harming, that kind of stuff. So some lobbyists from some groups, okay, have gotten on the web and tried to mess with me. They didn't realize that I enjoy it.
Yeah.
I enjoy humiliating fraudsters or what is called charlatan. I enjoy it. So it's just, you know, it's not a good use of my time. I know, but I'm human, you know. So
if All right, that's fair.
You don't have an hour a week to play with people you don't like. What do you do with that time, right?
Take a quick break. If you like this episode, I'd really, really appreciate it. It means so much to me. Please share it with your friends and subscribe to the podcast. Email me at altitude@gmail.com and tell me why you subscribed. Thanks.
Let's, for the listeners, take a step back and talk about what is fragility versus anti-fragility.
This whole episode of anti-fragility can only be explained, and this whole episode, like what I went through, my own, how did I get to the idea, can only be explained by the quest to figure out risk. Okay.
And risk, again, at a personal level and a global level,
everything. Risk doesn't have actually a definition, which is the strangest thing. And risk requires you, you know, to look at events and assign probability to them and see if they're going to occur. What's the risk of an earthquake, right? And if you look, and I dug down, I spent 20 years trying to define risk. I couldn't. Nobody has, all right? The only definition of risk we have is what risk-averse people don't like, all right? And probabilities are very hard to compute, particularly small probabilities. Like risk of ruin is very hard to compute.
You know, particularly you don't even know what curve or what law to apply to the
risk. I mean, you have a risk in some domains, what I call them thin-tailed domains, where the Gaussian curve works and some other distribution, we can figure out the risk. Like, for example, I know that the risks of falling from ladders, or if people killed falling from ladders, is not going to double, all right, next year, you see? So we know that that rate is well captured by common statistics.
What about risk, actuarial?
So the actuarial risk works for these, but you cannot use that for terrorism.
Right.
How many? You can't use it for wars. You can't use... You can't use it for a stock market. You cannot
and this is a problem. Many traders, this is why I mentioned the Victor Niederhofer, tends to apply a normal curve to
or whatever curve. It's not. It doesn't. If it's not. It's not the fact that it's normal or not normal. It's whether it's computable. The normal curve or that class of things assigns such a small probability to rare events that tend to make things computable.
Right. See,
because average events are sort of predictable. Right. But who cares? Because they have no impact. So anyway. So I realized that we didn't know much about risk. I don't know whether the probability of an earthquake tomorrow, you know, here, what is the odds of the stock market tripling, or these I can't. But on the other hand, what I can understand very well is how events affect me. So this is what I went to the literature and figured out something that very often people conflate. I call it the conflation of events and exposure. Conflates how events, right, the probability of events and how, the risk of events occurring and the risk to them from these events. Let's take an example. If you have the stock market can crash tomorrow, that's a big risk. But if you own out of the money puts on a stock market, okay, and you're pretty comfortable with the seller, you know, the seller of those puts would be in business, then you don't care about the stock market crashes, you see. Or if you express your view to start, you know, in the stock market just with calls. So who understood that very well? Chapter one of my technical document called Silent Risk, chapter one, the lawyers. They still understand it very well. The lawyer doesn't make a statistical, gives you statistical predictions of events. He hedges you against them by reducing your liability and constructing your liability. So it hit me that when I was an option trader, and I was an option trader for 21 years, largely in exotic and complex derivatives, and all I worked on is try to understand the payoff. And all I did wasn't try to understand the world, as people think traders try to do, is try to figure out, all right, a way to reduce liability from certain class of events.
And you would ignore that outlier?
Contractually, because contractually you can eliminate that, all right? Contractually, by defining your contract, you know, that contract doesn't cover this, you know, cancels if that so happens, or something like that. So I realized, you know, okay, so the first thing is that we don't understand risk, but we understand exposure. And we had 2,000 years, more than 2,000 years, probability was born with lawyers.
But right? Don't you think we also ignore exposure?
Sorry?
Don't you think we ignore exposure in general? Like, because we assume that the worst is not going to happen
to us. No, no. People, yeah, but we ignore exposure, or sometimes we overestimate exposure, but at least we understand exposure and you can construct exposure. But So I figured out that divorce. And then one day it hit me looking at a coffee cup, all right, that I could define fragility.
While looking at a coffee cup,
as I said,
was it one of the Greek coffee cups?
Yeah. It was a coffee cup on a table, and I was looking at it. I looked at it. I said, "Oh boy, I can." And Anti-Fragile started that day. All right, I started writing it. I started doing the math behind it. I said, "For 20 some years, I've been an option trader, and we have a definition of things that don't like volatility. You see, the things, you know, think of a coffee cup." If there's any random event in a room, not one of them will help it. It'll be either neutral or negative. So we have an asymmetry. Right. The things suffer from, they have more downside than upside. I looked at it, I said, this coffee cup is short. In my option language, we call it short gamma or short volatility. Mm. I looked at it, I said, we have a definition of fragility. Can I generalize to everything, okay, fragile, being negatively affected by volatility? Yes, I can. If I can do that, then I can do something because I spent my time as an option trader and also I did my PhD. So I did everything on some specific, you know, properties, all right, of option complex option packages. So I just said, okay, everything that doesn't like volatility is fragile and everything fragile likes volatility. So, and everything flew from there. So you can construct a prism, all right, to view the world in three categories. The fragile, like short and option, if there's volatility, it's exposed to it. It can blow up, it can suffer, whatever, the various degrees.
So let's give some examples of fragile. So like you give one example, which I thought was great, an old woman who likes everything to be 70 degrees, well, okay, an average of 70 degrees is bad because if it's 140 degrees, she's dead, and if it's 0 degrees, she's dead.
Exactly. To explain this, we need one point to explain it. Which is to explain the link between a coffee cup and the old lady, an elderly person who doesn't like thermal variability, which is as follows, is that the whatever you can show mathematically, and this I think is important, okay, because it generalizes to so many things, and now I'm working with physicists and on the thing about GMOs and global warming on risk. What is important is that what doesn't like volatility doesn't like variation, doesn't like stressors, doesn't like time. You remember we started the conversation talking about time. What doesn't like volatility doesn't like time. Why? Time is volatility. It's more events happening.
Right.
You see? And doesn't like entropy, doesn't like stressors. And you can very easily establish, make a table of what are the things that what doesn't like volatility doesn't like. And put them all in the same group, the fragile. So the fragile doesn't like time. Sorry?
It's a huge group. It's a much bigger group than anti-fragile.
But whatever doesn't like one won't like the others. This is what the interesting thing. What doesn't like time doesn't like unpredictability and doesn't like stressors and doesn't like randomness and doesn't like uncertainty and doesn't like an increased scale of distribution and doesn't like all these things.
I feel like you're describing all my emotional relationships with people.
Okay, no, but up to a point, of course. Some are open-ended, some. So this is what doesn't like time. So this is the fragile, all right? A coffee cup is fragile, okay? But with respect, you're always fragile with respect to one. All right, what I call source of variation or source of randomness or source of stress. Like, for example, the elderly person is probably extremely fragile with respect to the changes in temperature, but she may not be fragile with respect to, emotional stuff.
Right, because she has experience.
Oh, whatever it is.
People have died.
Some people are very domain dependent and what they're fragile about. Someone could be a weightlifter and is dumped by his girlfriend and go jump from a cliff. Okay, so you can't really transfer from one domain to the other. So now we have an idea.
Humans can do that, and it's interestingly. So humans have an ability to adapt to multiple let's say, social hierarchies. So I can be in one domain, like handle things emotionally, but not be able to handle extreme changes in temperature, whereas other mammals or other animals almost can't adapt to anything. Humans are more adaptable.
Yeah, we are. But that's the thing that's very important to understand, that humans are, the reason we're successful is because we are, not adaptable, but we have a broader, we depend from, we can make it through different environments, thermally, right? And also, it's very important, we are omnivorous. We can eat everything,
right?
And omnivores. And omnivores are rare. It means we can eat like a lion and eat like a cow, you see, and do fine in both cases. And the problem is people don't understand that we are not omnivores by choice. Hence, we need variability in the food supply. And we need some deprivation of some food groups once in a while, because that's how we became omnivores.
Ah, that's the stressor to the system. Stressor make us anti-fragile.
Exactly, particularly protein. And I said that if we're part lion, part cow, the cow has no randomness in the way it eats, but the lion has more randomness. So you have to have protein less steadily than other food groups.
So I see. So in the areas where you're anti-fragile, you want to encourage variability.
Exactly. So let's put some the structure. We said the fragile doesn't like variation and variability, all right? And we're always fragile with respect to something. The robust doesn't really care, you see. And, of course, the anti-fragile on the right needs variability. And as a matter of fact, it dies if it doesn't have that variability.
So if you just eat protein...
If you just eat protein, you probably would have no kidneys in no time, all right? You need... We're made for variability among food groups. If you just eat carbs, you also have a problem. But the thing is, what people didn't understand when they started following the paleo diet is that to follow our ancestors' methods, to follow our ancestors what they did, you need to match not the food composition so much as the food frequency. And I just posted the other day, I was in some airport, and I did the fractal thing about how often we should fast to be consistent with some with the environment. You should also have the stressor of fasting.
Interesting, because so, you mentioned briefly an anti-fragile. There's no proof that breakfast really gives you energy for
exactly.
The day.
Exactly. This is the most important thing, is to follow the following guidelines, all right? Science is great. It should give us proofs. But if there's a habit that is not part of our tradition and has not been tested for its benefits, then you should be suspicious. And breakfast is one of them. Does a lion eat to hunt, or do you hunt to eat? All right, so you don't need energy visibly, and if you supply yourself too much energy, then you dull your system, and we are a metabolic system. Now, strangely, this idea that I wrote about an anti-fragile, I thought nobody would get it. People have independently, okay, of course, have been doing research on fasting, on if you're keto adapted, that fasting is important, The someone, there have been a few bestsellers on that 7-2 diet after anti-fragile, repeating the exact same ideas. But to do it right, you don't, you know, follow a regimen of fasting one day a week, or you see once every 2 weeks. So you need to randomize. In other words, you should fast. If you fast one day every week, you should also fast 3 days every month and a half, and a whole week every 2 years.
I love this idea.
But if you're made for a statistical environment that has variability, like thermal variability or food group variability or frequency of feeding variability, and you don't have that in your life, you are not human. You're becoming something else. Unfortunately, we have too much control of our environment. So we are made just for an environment that has, variability, but risk came with variability, because it's the same thing. Just like, We had preferences for sugar because it came with nutrition, right? Mm. But, you know, it also comes with heart problems, but, you know, but we need nutrition. But the environment didn't give us the granularity to differentiate between small quantities and large quantities, you see, because we didn't have that chance. The same thing with variability. We could not control our environment. So we disliked variability and randomness. And now we live in an environment where we can control that small randomness, and it's killing us, you see. So you can kill someone literally by feeding them too steadily, and effectively that's how diabetes comes from. And how was the evidence? I read the papers, cited many of them in Anti-Fragile, but many came out later, that effectively all these fasting stuff that have been experimented up to 4 days by Walter Longo, by Batson, by all these people, realize that there are some benefits, but there's also especially a absence of other diseases that come with it, you see. So for example, epileptic seizures for children, we know that you know, drugs are good, but the first, the most effective thing to start with is avoidance of sugar, right? Avoidance of carbs, okay. And another thing is diabetes. Diabetes is the first thing should be to starve someone for a while to teach, you know, to the stressor and see if, and you can figure out how often they have diabetes, okay, by the frequency of famine. And you can back from the disease, you can get the statistical properties of famine and our habitat from that. And this is mathematically very easy to do. Nobody has done it, but I mean, I have a sketch of how it's be done. For example, if you starve yourself for a day once in a while, you have some benefits with asthma, okay? So you know asthma comes from this, okay? It doesn't come from this, but you can make a statistical link, and then you can say, okay, diabetes has this link.
So you're not saying what asthma comes from. You're saying how asthma could be avoided.
Saying that negativa. There's a mismatch between us and the environment, okay. You see? And it looks like because we have a spate of diseases that we had to have at least one starvation day every fortnight, you see.
Right.
You have to have a week every year or something. You can back out from the environment what the shape of that statistical curve should be, you see, with some comfortable precision. So anyway, so to go back to the structure that we have the fragile, the robust, and the anti-fragile, right? What makes the anti-fragile very powerful is that you can measure if something is anti-fragile from local sensitivity. And that is what is interesting for us. Like, for example, why am I making statements that fasting is good for you, like that stress or deprivation? You have to have some acceleration of gain locally, just like you have to have some acceleration of harm locally for something to be fragile. And let me explain it, right?
Oh, I can see with fasting, you could have both.
Yeah, but let me go back to the definition of fragile to see how we can go from there, from one to the other, because it's always easier to explain the fragile than the anti-fragile, mostly because our brains are risk-averse, you see. So let me explain the fragile first. The first thing you know when you're short volatility in the markets is that a 10% drop in the market harms you a lot more, okay, than twice a 5% drop, you see. Okay. Likewise, if you jump 10 meters, you're harmed a lot more than twice if you jump 5 meters. Actually, 10 meters, you'd go, all right? So, and 5 meters again, in turn, is a lot better, you know, a lot worse once 5 meters than two times the risk of 2.5 meters and so on. And things have to be that way, because if the curve were linear, you see, then you would die just walking. So you have to have, you know, if I smash my car against a wall at 50 kilometers per hour, I'm harmed a lot more than 50 times if I smash it at 1 kilometer per hour, you see? So, and this is a property of everything that has survived. Why? Because things that are linear to harm are already gone. So the fragile, you can detect acceleration. If you have acceleration of harm, you see, if you start having acceleration of harm locally, then you can detect fragility.
So fragility is almost related to almost a survival of the fittest, because we control the environment of our
I'm talking about something technical here, but I'll get to that. In other words, the way fragility has to show acceleration of harm, you see, it has to come with it. you have to have acceleration of arm, some kind of, I call it a concavity argument. Likewise, anti-fragility has to show some acceleration of benefit somewhere. You see, and if you detect that, then you have a local anti-fragility. And maybe I'll give you a MOOC, many MOOC I gave the students, 5 minutes, where I explained that with curves. Why, so, if you have, and let me explain why acceleration of benefits. Is it better for you to have, for example, if you're convex, to have when say you have lung ventilator, all right? If it's better for you to have 100% of the dose all the time, or 50% one time, 150% the other time?
Yeah, it would be probably much worse.
No, much better.
Oh, yeah?
Exactly. So, and then I mentioned an antifragile, that lung ventilators, people made the mistake of thinking you need steadiness. If you have that convexity effect, which means that 50% one day, 1 minute, 150% the other minute, is a lot better than 100% of the dose all the time, then you're antifragile. And that shows an acceleration on a graph. You see? So it's the same thing with a coffee cup. You want to hit it with intensity of 2 per, say, intensity of 2. You can hit it 100 times intensity of 2, it won't break. But if you half the time intensity of 1, half the time intensity of 3, it would break. You see? Right. So if the linear combination of 2 different numbers is worse, you're fragile. And if the linear combination is better, you're anti-fragile. Let's apply it to feeding, right? Or to the temperature. Is it better to spend the whole day at 70 degrees for your health, or spend some time at 50 degrees and some time at 90 degrees? Well, obviously, it's better for your health to have that variation. So a linear combination of 50 degrees and 90 degrees is better for your health than just 70 degrees. It means you're anti-fragile. You can keep varying that interval to see up to what point, because visibly we're fragile if you, instead of having 10 degrees variation or 20 degrees variation, you go to 100 degree variation. Yeah, you would die in both cases. So you're fragile when it starts harming you, the interval, and widening and narrowing the interval for the same, keeping the same average.
It seems like an anti-fragility in that case is like almost like a donut.
So exactly.
It fragility is in the middle and fragility on the outside. So the variability is too much, I'm fragile again.
Something like randomness. Yeah, and let me, now you're talking about evolution, let me talk about evolution. Evolution, without randomness, you don't have evolution, because you don't have, the fitness. There are a lot of mechanisms of evolution. One of them is noise in your DNA, okay? If you have no noise, okay, and the DNA is transmitted without replicating error, because every time someone has a child, there's a replicating mistake, or not every time, but statistically, there are mistakes in replicating the DNA. So if you try giving a DNA deterministically without mistakes, you don't have evolution. But if you have mistakes, you're going to have 10 offspring, some of them will benefit from the mistake, all right, then you have evolution, all right? Those who benefit get an advantage and keep going. So replication error is good. So something that likes an error, all right, has some advantages. The problem is if your error rate is too high, you will never conserve the benefit. So you have to have some error rate, not too high and not too low. And this is why I say that anti-fragility is local. It's good, for example, to have 1 per 1,000 error rate, for example, because it's good. But if you have 10% error rate, then your offspring will not retain that advantage to transmit it to their own. So anti-fragile is local, except in finance, where it's sort of, finance is always weird, where you can have things that benefit from volatility with no ceiling contractually, or some things may have a high ceiling. Again, use the concept of anti-fragile and convexity, and I'll show you where we're okay. Lift weight. What's better to build muscle? To lift 1,000 times 1 kilo or 1 pound or one time 100 pound?
I wouldn't be able to lift 1,000 times 1 pound, so yeah, I'd have to go with 100. I wouldn't be able to lift 1,000 kilos.
No, no, no. What I meant is 100 times 1 pound or 1 time 100 pounds.
Oh, I would say 1 time 100 pounds.
Okay, so there you go. So there you get the convexity. Is that every pound gives you more benefits, you see, for given the same amount, total amount that you're going
to lift. To a certain point.
But visibly, you're not going to have health benefits lifting 1,000 pounds because then you would break your...
Yeah, repetitive stress disorder.
No, no, no. 1,000 pounds will break your bones.
Right.
Whatever it is, if you
if you lift 100 times 1 pound, you just get repetitive stress disorder. You won't
exactly.
You won't build any muscle.
Exactly. So the whole idea of anti-fragile is understanding what I call the convexity effect. The convexity effect, if a linear combination of two things, all right, is better, you know, than one thing of the same average.
But what I like about that is you don't have to explain why something works, because then you go into the realm of, mythology. You just have to understand this, measuring this aspect.
Exactly. I'm very skeptical of people who try to understand the mechanism. And
well, like, why does 100-pound weight build muscle? We don't really know.
Exactly. So, and I said it here in the book. I said that, when I started weightlifting, I was told, hey, there are micro tears that fill up, you know, and then you eat your protein and you have a protein shake and a micro tear that fill up with muscle and everybody's happy because of the tear. Okay, that's a very nice story. But then I came back and asked, yeah, but how come the lion has so much muscle without working out, all right? Well, they say, well, it's hormonal, all right? They say, hormonal. And then discover that people who take steroids grow in muscles, all right? So you realize that muscle growth is something informational that doesn't seem to have much to do with the way people used to interpret it. But so the theory behind muscle growth will change maybe every generation and we'll never converge because science doesn't work, doesn't have definitive answers. We'll never fully converge. But the fact that if I lift 100 pounds, I will gain muscle will never change.
Right, so when you can observe...
Phenomenology is robust, okay? Theories, the explanation, are not. And people yet have more respect for theory than phenomenology. Phenomenology is cataloging things that have monstrous regularity without really understanding the reason. And I don't have to explain that to you what the mechanism by which if I hit someone on the head, okay, he's going to, not do well, right? You have to explain the blood vessel. The fact is it won't change the story at all. So we have, in my book, our methodology is very robust, right? Phenomenology is very robust, okay? It does catalog things that we know that if you overeat, you're going to gain weight. Now, what's a pathway that will store the, who cares, right? If we focus on these things that we know, we do a lot better, you see. I'm not against science. I'm against interpreting scientific theories as truths rather than focusing on robust phenomenologies, you see. And statistical regularities are part of that phenomenology, you see. The way we handle randomness is part of that phenomenology. And there are some things that are necessary, mathematically necessary, absolutely necessary mathematically. Like, for example, that if you... are convex, in other words, if 80% of it, then necessarily you like variability. Then necessarily you are anti-fragile, and that thing. Then necessarily you benefit from random supply of that thing. If you do better, and you take those books on starvation now, there are many, many of them showing how cancer cells do, okay, but if you look at it, you say people effectively do better after X days of starvation, and then they can eat all they want. So visibly, instead of eating 2,000 calories for 8 days, they eat zero, and then they can eat the rest. They do a lot better, okay? Mm. But you don't have to go into the mechanism to understand that that's a regularity, you see, that you can... And from that, you can make mathematical statement without having to understand the process at all because it's necessary.
Well, let me ask you a question. Because we've removed so far... Let's say because we have this controlled environment that we can control, do you have to now measure statistically to get us back to...
Exactly. That's the problem. Okay. Let's go back to life, all right? We had no control over transportation. So we walked a lot, right? And now we got better. We can make life comfortable with a car, okay? Now, what do? You drive your car to the gym to compensate for it, you see, and walk on a treadmill, you see. Normally, that's completely absurd, but we do that, no? Mm-hmm. That's a compensating fact to fix it. But this is not something new. The Greek Orthodox religion forces us to have 200 vegan days.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, because in opulent societies, you know, you overeat on lamb, you know, you're going to be harmed. So we have 200, including 40 days of Lent, or entirely vegan. You go through 40 days of purely vegan, stuff. We have Ramadan in Islam. If it's done properly, you should, you know, and Judaism has 6 days of fasting, plus recommended a lot of rabbis fast X number of days, just to have a clear mind. So if you look at, so these are compensators. There's no different from going to the gym to compensate from the fact that we have too much control of our environment. And it's the same thing with a lack of coal. I was you have saunas, all right, where you induce variation, okay, and you have reverse saunas. I was in Qatar, a place I hope, you know, not go back because I don't like their politics, and they may make me force me to stay there anyway. So I was in Qatar, and I noticed that they had a reverse sauna, which is a room where temperature is kept at something like minus 20 degrees centigrade, where you go for a minute, maximum minute, do a reverse sauna. All right. Mm-hmm. Now all these things come from the fact that we have too much control of our environment. And thermal stability and mechanical stability and these things are, effectively weakening us. Hmm.
But so, then you have to measure whether that's now we're in a position where we have to measure if that's good or not.
Well, we can guess pretty much. I mean, we can guess that if you don't walk too much, you're going to gain weight. You're going to do this. You're going to have this. You can guess that if you don't, you know, go lift weight in the gym, that's your bone density will do so. So you can pretty much calibrate your life to have enough. And most people do, who live healthy lives, you know, live in cities where they walk a lot. Well, now it's impossible. You know, at some point it was easy to drive in New York City. Now it's impossible. So somehow our environment also is forcing us to go back to more ancestral methods.
Right. And you mentioned there's an anti-fragility there because people might complain, oh, I'm stuck in traffic, but, I'm in a city where, or there is some anti-fragility there where I'm in a city where everybody wants to go. So the fact that I'm in harm means I'm in a popular place where there might be money and opportunities
Exactly. It's not, you don't complain about traffic. It means other people want to be there as well.
Yeah. Right?
It's just that there's something very interesting, by the way, about traffic is traffic is highly nonlinear. And people made mistakes of not predicting traffic based on local response of delays, like the city of New York wasn't good at understanding the linearity of traffic. That if you shut off a bridge, for example, the 59th Street Bridge for a film on Saturday, don't predict that it's going to slow down traffic by 10 minutes. It took me 4.5 hours. I was stuck in a car, right? So, of course, it's my mistake to drive to New York City, but that was for dinner. You see the idea, incidentally, talking about traffic. Now, it's very important to realize that risk is not variability, but our instinct mixes the two of them. Mm. Like in finance, people think that risk is something that moves. No, risk is something that makes you go bust, right? Because things that move aren't necessarily risky, but that's what people are afraid of.
That's very interesting, because variability you can measure. Whether something moves or not, you can see.
Exactly.
But risk, for me, is different than risk for you. Risk for each person is different.
Risk, depending on the definition of risk.
Risk of loss.
Fragility, we define fragility as much easier to measure, all right? You can say, okay, at what point will this break? There is some mapping of risk to fragility in some cases called ruin, total ruin, right? What's the probability of total ruin? Okay. But typically, risk is not what we think is risk, because most people who try to control variability of portfolio blow up. I said that forests, if you try to control the fires in forest, you end up letting the bad material accumulate, and then the forest, you know what happened to these forests when there's a fire. The same thing with emerging market governments. I remember controlling their currency. Like, I saw Mexico in 1994 moving like 30-some% of the currency, right? I'm still talking like a trader, like I started saying the Mexican peso, we call it Mexico, right? So I still remember, and what happened is that if you control volatility, bring it to zero, the minute you have a small move, it's out of control, you see. We've all seen Argentina freezing the currency for a long time, and then the minute you let it float, or right. You're forced to let it float, or it floats by itself, you know what happens. So controlling variability has never been a good idea in any domain. You have to have some element of variation for things that are alive.
So what, other than, like, let's say the financial markets, what are some clear areas where you see people trying to control variability?
Well, I mean, I wrote on the Black Swan that Syria was going to blow up because they had no political variability. You know, you need maximum political variability because things blow up otherwise. Flammable material, as I said. And if you generalize it, you realize that you want a municipal system where you have maximum variability because you have more, it's more of a continuum rather than have a president at the top.
It's like a Switzerland type of...
Like a Switzerland top municipal system with a lot of distributed decision-making, you know, with small mistakes made here and there. So, but Syria, the next one is Saudi Arabia, right, will be the next shoe to drop. They have had zero political variability. So the minute there's something, nobody knows how deep it can get, or if it can control it. In a political domain, in a lot of domains, absence of variability is bad. I mean, actually, something I discovered recently, if your heart has too steady a beat, the heartbeat is very steady, guess what? It's predictive of mortality.
That's interesting.
It's very predictive. So
this is what I get worried about. And I actually wrote you this in an email recently. I myself have never been to a hospital, have not gotten sick. I'm worried if I ever do get sick, my body will just blow up.
No, it could be, it could be with age that you're getting sick. In fact, I'm getting over it.
Maybe, it could be.
I don't know, but I didn't look at, infectious diseases aren't so much my domain.
I'm just worried that my mind won't be able to handle it once I get sick because I'll be so, so fragile about the concept of getting sick.
Really? Maybe induce yourself, go to some country or you can contract.
Get malaria or something.
Not malaria, something less chronic. Where,
yeah.
I don't know. It's interesting.
But you mentioned that in the book, in Anti-Fragile, that you do have an anti-fragile personal program for yourself. Like you like to, for instance, walk on uneven surfaces.
Uneven surfaces. I like to walk on rocks, not walk on roads.
And there's evidence, actually, that walking on rocks, for instance, increases lifespan. They've done
I broke a nose initially, but since then I've been doing rather well. And it's, you know, I feel alive after I walk. And I think that we didn't understand sleep for a long time. People trying to reduce sleep and then, you know, having problems elsewhere. I think we also don't understand walking. I say if statistically we've been walking so much in our history, okay, I need a very convincing reason, all right, to stop doing so. And there's none, okay? So I try to walk. It's pretty much what I try to do as main activity. Okay, my activity is some 20-some hours a week. Minimum. But I've noticed one thing is to have a comfortable life, I wake up in the morning, I don't want to have any obligation except walking. And if I walk on something, like sleeping on something, or, you know, you walk, and I try not to think of that thing at all. Say I have to write an article. And at the minute I'm stuck, I don't try to make an effort. I just walk. And I come back, all right? Sometimes I come back and it pours out on its own. So in other words, never make an effort locally to try to solve a math problem or do something.
Stare at a blank screen or a blank page.
No, nothing. No, make no effort. There's no, life is too short, okay? Just go take a walk and think of something else. And I think, I'm sure some mechanism works better when I walk because I'm you know, my main activity since I've been, you know, full-time into scholarship and stuff like that, I've been reading and walking, right? And the more I walk, the more, I don't spend a lot of time writing. It just comes out, right? If I don't walk, I have this blank screen business, and then you get in trouble. So walking is No, is necessary.
So walking increases the stress.
I don't know the mechanism. I absolutely don't know.
Right,
I'm making no statement, no explanation mechanism. But I look at statistically how much we've been doing it, and I apply it, and it seems to work. So in other words, I don't have to have to come up with an explanation to follow Mother Nature, particularly if I have a hugely positive payoff from it.
Right.
But then, if I'm going against walking, then I want to see the evidence. Right? You see the idea? If I'm going against the natural. And I don't walk on a treadmill or kind of nonsense. I just walk outside.
So what else is part of your anti-fragile program, your personal one?
My personal one is when I go to a country, drink local water. One, for ethical reasons, you've got to drink the water, but non-purified a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So just that's the anti-fragile thing. It reduces surprises, right? So we have had so much control of our hygiene that people are forced now to take pills with bacteria. Isn't it absurd? So exactly like driving to the treadmill.
Well, so it's always my theory that the peanut allergies this generation, which we never had before, it's caused by too much
because people don't understand, plus overusing antibiotics. Okay, so what I do is I follow the principles that risk is what to worry about, not comfort. So take no medicine, except if I have something very, very severe, in which case I don't see one doctor, I see four of them. And I follow...
Fourth opinion.
Not four opinion. And if someone gives you one, and I double the dose even if necessary. You see the idea? So medicine is very nonlinear to condition. And let me give you the rationale. If you have slightly above normal hypertension, all right, like slightly, if you're above the normal tensive, and you take medicine, the number needed to treat is something like 1 in 100, one and 60. In other words, the number of people who benefit from the medication is very small.
Is that usually true?
If it's slightly one standard deviation away from normal, right? So that is.
That's fascinating.
But if you're four standard deviations away from normal, or three standard deviation away from normal, something in that area, okay, and you can use standard deviation because the Gaussian, it's sort of Gaussian, then the numbers needed to treat are monstrously lower. Something like 75% benefit from the drug.
So if you were told you had cancer, you wouldn't take any chemotherapy drugs?
I'd not try. But if someone tells me I have a headache, take this medicine, I wouldn't take it. Mm. Plus, there's some feedback. If I start taking medicine from headache, then I'm not limiting the cause, just a symptom. But no, to go back, so it tells you, but the harm from medicine is the same. Whether you're high, hypo, you see that is the same. So the ratio of gain, all right, is not there for mild condition. But the problem is pharma has a difficulty finding people who are very sick. So because there are 5,000 more people who are very, slightly hypertensive than very hypertensive. You see, and this is why we tend to overtreat people, and so you have to let the variation and the stressors take care of themselves. They make you better, and make sure the extreme is taken care of.
Okay, so this is a great field. So medicine. What's another area? Personally, what about like in relationships?
In relation, I don't know. I have a very boring, a very boring.
Seems like marriage is a fragile thing.
I don't know. I've seen people, all right, who have, who don't know how to manage, the social life, okay, relationship and overall with their friends, partners and stuff like that. And I try to avoid these people, okay, completely. And put them, I cut losses very quickly as a trader. So if you see someone, a business person who had a problem with a partner, I cross the street. I may have coffee with them, but I will never do business. So this is something you learn is some people are troublemakers and to stay out of, that. But in social relationships, can disruptive people be helpful? In other words, can have anti-fragility by having disruptive people in social? I don't know. I try to avoid disruptive people, and also, but I myself try to be disruptive if I don't like something.
Although you, it sounds like you selectively expose yourself to stressors, like on Twitter or something.
No, but Twitter is not a stressor. Twitter is I'm enjoying the media medium, and it's calculated. It's much more calculated by picking on targets that I don't like a couple of economists and publicly. So,
right.
But on in private life, I haven't had many. I don't know if in private life I've had many fights, except you see some person drunk at a party and I, you know, control the person and get him out. But
you don't expose yourself to variability there. You stay around positive people.
I don't. I haven't had street fights in a long time, right? Haven't had, no street fights, no actually shouting match, nothing.
But, you know, it's funny, thinking of fighting, like gaming in general, like chess, it's good to study multiple openings so you understand chess better, to have variability in your knowledge.
I don't know. I mean, I didn't think, all I thought about is that I remember, you know, figuring out that being good at chess doesn't make you necessarily good at other things.
That's definitely true.
It's very domain specific, but is it also, how much transfers? I've had a lot of stories. I don't know how much transfers. But so this is why I try to avoid analogies to game, because life doesn't resemble games. And
right.
People think life resembles games tend to get in trouble. But I think that you have to have an element of surprise in your life. Okay. Now let's talk about life. Okay. What I think is a way to be, you know, non-fragile in your life. If you're an employee, you're fragile for life.
Because even if you're promoted or demoted, it's unpleasant for you. It's fragile. Because if you're promoted, you got a small increase in salary, but a huge increase in responsibility.
Exactly. My point is, if you're going to be employed, better be the lowest person, the night guard at a company,
right.
Or someone who...
No responsibilities, and you get responsibilities. Income.
And you get income, and then you can write poetry at night, or be a painter, or do things. And in developed countries, it's, you know, like Switzerland, if you want to be a writer, it's much better to be a work at the minimum wage, then you're very comfortable, rather than be a university English teacher or a German teacher or whatever it is, to write books. So the being an employee makes you very fragile, because the way people start viewing the world, prevents them from following their own ethical inclinations.
Right, like, so they'll choose to make an ethical exception to get a promotion, for instance.
Or no, for example, you may work for a tobacco company, right? You may buy stock in a tobacco company because you have a budget to make. So these are ethical dilemmas that you cannot escape when you're employed.
It's similar then, you know, to make a budget. So owning a home makes you more fragile than renting.
Well, it depends. I mean, to be personally, I never borrowed a penny, all right? Almost never. I had an arbitrage once on my first job.
Trading doesn't count.
No, at Bankers Trust. After that, but I noticed that people who have a mortgage have, of course, are the prisoners of the system, and they underestimate the duration of their employment. And when they start fearing the boss, and if the boss calls them to their office, they're in trouble. If you have money on the side, you're much more robust, okay? And money on the side is the opposite of debt. It's like having an extra reserve. You don't have to predict what's going to harm you. And you depend less on a boss getting rid of you. Because if the boss doesn't like you, can you imagine how miserable it is, how unnatural a life it is, being in an office for 30 years with someone you hate, all right?
And many
Whereas
people do
in
it.
In nature, you've been killed or you would have killed within minutes, right? Mm-hmm. So, and many people, this is a stressor that's not good for you. The chronic stressor is not good for you. The varying stressor and the high intensity once in a while stressor is good for you, you see? And of course, it maps to what Sapolsky have established about acute versus chronic stressor and stuff like that. But stressor with recovery, that is. But to go back to having a good life is I plot an anti-fragile. I compare a taxi driver in London who has high randomness visibly to his brother who's an employee of a cushy job, making the exact same salary, very predictable. If his brother loses his job, he's gone. a taxi driver is protected by the variability because the variability forces them to adjust. So if you don't have business near Heathrow, you try to find another airport, you see? Or maybe, you know, you try to find nightclubs. You're adapted. You're if you're making a living from as a taxi driver in London, you're adapted to the environment, you see, because every trade is a new trade, as they say.
And even if a disruptive company comes along like an Uber, you can just become an Uber driver.
Well, you can move around. But his brother spent 30 years in a cushy with a company. The company has a financial problem. He's gone. And he's not going to land another job at age 53, right? Something quite important. Every system that's organic communicates with its environment via stressors. So your lift weight, it's a stressor. Your system will code for higher, higher bone density and more muscle. You see, you go in the sun, you get the signal, and then you'll code for more protection from the sun. So you get suntanned. All right.
I like your point in Anti-Fragile that we've been in the sun for millions of years and never got like skin cancer from it, as far as we know. That
I didn't make that point so much that I was questioning the idea of avoiding radiation completely, except if you don't have the racial characteristics and racial the skin tone characteristics of the area in which you live.
Right,
like if you're an Irish person living in Australia, there's a problem, right? But if you're an Irish person living in Ireland, I don't know, you see?
Right.
And effectively, it looks like, and now we have evidence, that a little bit of radiation is very good for you to protect you from cancer. So elimination of radiation makes you fragile. Just like a little bit of bacteria is good for you to protect you from bacteria, you see. If you live in a sterilized room, you're not going to do very well when you come out of it. So it's among these class of things. But so when you are professionally a consultant, okay, you're not an employee, a consultant, you're going to have variability in your income. But every morning, if you're still making a living, all right, you're fit for whatever environment there is, right?
So, okay, so there you're minimally resilient, but not yet anti-fragile.
You have to get minimally robust, okay, to get in the right direction of anti-fragile, mm-hmm. You see. Something anti-fragile is effectively something that gains from stressors to the system and improve from it. We have also to avoid looking at humans as a unit. You have to look at systems, you see. So sometimes the fragility of the person is necessary for the safety of the system. Take the restaurant business. If a restaurant weren't fragile, wouldn't go bankrupt, you wouldn't have a healthy restaurant business where people can eat well. So how can the individual, right, be, what can you do in that environment? In that environment, you have to make sure that you're capable of starting a new restaurant very quickly.
So it's almost like you have to build the sensibility that if this restaurant fails, at least I'll have the experience to build a better restaurant.
You had the other one, exactly. And then you have to integrate that failure in your learning curve. But to really be anti-fragile, you have to be in a business of trial and error, where all your side effects are going to be beneficial. And there's no business, it used to be, no longer like that, that benefited from its own mistakes better than pharma. Because if you're in that business, you make a mistake with hypertension medicine has a side effect. Well, that side effect leads to Viagra, for example. Well, that's the good news, you see. And effectively, if you look at, I have a big bone with academic research, with everything, you know, trying to exactly map the environment, thinking we understand it, and fooling ourselves, rather than focusing on payoff, again, trying to predict rather than focus on exposure, have a convex exposure, anti-fragile exposure, is something like the best model is cooking. You cannot imagine, right, what something could taste like just from writing down on a piece of paper the chemical composition. You cannot. No, you have to try. Mm-hmm. Well, that protects us from having too many theories in cooking. And then everything goes by trial and error. So, but why does trial and error work well? Whereas I'm trying to make the perfect hummus. I add an ingredient, right? It doesn't taste good. I give it to my mother-in-law. you see? So your downside is small, but if I hit on something great, then I'll have my great humus, you see. Mm-hmm. So pharma works that way, and the rate of growth of medical research in gains and finding drugs and cures and all that was much higher under trial and error than today that we think we understand biology. Mm-hmm. You see, so given that we make mistakes, we might as well be in an environment where we benefit from mistakes. You see, so the restaurant industry benefits from the mistake of its members to improve. The airline, or the transportation industry, every plane crash reduces the probability of the next plane crash, benefits from its mistake. So that's a healthy system, but it's not necessarily always good news for the people at the bottom. But nevertheless, we can say that if they died, all right, at least they've saved more lives, all right, than the ones that perished.
Do you think, so given like the current economy, which is sort of floating on top of these bailouts from 2009, what's your stance?
Well, I mean, bailouts are, of course, against my religion, against everything I believe in, because you're disrupting a system, creating moral hazard.
You didn't let the crash happen.
But the counterfactual is wrong. My peers say, well, would you have saved the economy, let it fail then? If... You know, it's a wrong counterfactual. You would have opposed bailout since 1982 when Mr. Reagan started bailing out the banks. 83, you know, when they bailed out Connell, Illinois, when it started, you know, having these systems. So the bailout situation is tricky. You cannot say, well, you have to look at it as an ensemble. Build a system that doesn't require bailout. And we know, you know, how to build these systems. What's the system that doesn't require bailout? Well, the first thing is you force everyone in banks that require bailout to be, you know, why are we bailing out the bank? It's too big. We're not bailing out the restaurant, although the consequences locally on the person and the staff are the same. No, they're going to be unemployed, Monday morning and with financial losses. But we don't care. We care about protecting the system. So if someone is making $20 million bonuses and we're going to bail him out, if he's wrong, that's wrong. So any business that's bailable out should not have these bonuses. Mm. And people tell me, well, we lose talent. I say the banking industry has proved only one talent, that of getting paid, you know, individually, because it's a business that never made money, you see. So... this is how you structure a system to be robust from the inside. You structure a business, the banking business, to be like the restaurant industry. You don't structure it to be something like government. So another thing that's very central for a system to work well is to have what I call skin in the game. In other words, people bear direct consequences for their action, not because it's a deterrent, but because it's a filter. Hmm. Because if you go bust yourself, you're out of the pool. You see, if you if you're a bad driver, okay, that's fine. You're allowed to be a bad driver, but you're not. We don't want you to harm others. So, if bad drivers tend to die because they get into accidents or kill other people, they would much more likely, all right, reduce the number of fatalities, all right, than if they didn't survive. Likely to kill, you know, those who kill other people driving. This is my idea of skin in the game. As a symmetric risk thing that causes bad risk takers, all right, to be harmed,
or at least learn if they're.
I don't believe in learning. I really don't believe in learning at the individual level. I believe systems learn through filters.
What about entrepreneurship, though? So if somebody starts a business and fails, they might learn from that experience.
Well, no. Yeah, they learn from the experience. And also the business model of entrepreneurship is what I was in, out of money options. I bought out of money options. I always lost money. And I was in business of, people.
It's very interesting. Like, entrepreneurship is like buying out of the money options.
Exactly. And you have people who kept telling me that I was doing the wrong thing, and they still work for a living, you see? And so you can only smile and say, okay, be polite to them. And they teach you and then my reason is that any error in model, all right, means the tails have to be more valued. more valuable. And it's a little complicated to do without a graph.
No, but that's interesting. So entrepreneurship is actually saying the tails have more value than anybody else thought before. And so you're going to develop
The world is built today by entrepreneurs. Everybody who short tails, there's no business that short tails. They're still in existence. Hmm. Insurance companies are the only one who do it because they do it with things that are thin-tailed and cap the tail. They don't have the exposure in the tail. Insurance companies, people don't understand that. Insurance companies, they don't sell tails. They sell the body distribution and they block you. For example, your house, they cap you, all right? What interests me is beyond the cap.
Right.
So I mean, I was in the business of buying tails, all right? Or at least protecting people from not having the tails and stuff like that. So it is, when you're in a business like that, you start looking at the world of tails and you see who understands tails and you realize entrepreneurship, if the tails weren't mispriced by the world, we wouldn't be where we are today. You see? Look at the wealth generated. Where did the wealth come from? All right-tailed things, businesses, computers, entrepreneurship is a right-tailed proposition, all right? And the businesses that were short the tail, there's three of them, all right? Banking is one, never made a penny. Another one is insurance, reinsurance. The ones that made even substandard stuff was because they were capping the tail, you see?
So let's take someone like Warren Buffett, though, who does catastrophic insurance on stadiums, say.
Well, cat insurance, the ones overwritten by these people, are not tail events because they're capped. And my tail starts beyond. I had recently someone, I was waiting. I said, I'm not going to attack and print my ideas until I'm waiting for someone to publish something criticizing my ideas and anti-fragile about the tails. In a journal, so I can publish it in a scientific journal. And some idiot who's a risk manager or whatever said, oh, Taleb is wrong. Look, there's no volatility. Tails are not volatility. Tail risk is how much of the volatility explained by the tail, you see? So it allowed me to make the point that a business that is fat-tailed, in other words, where the tail plays a large role, has usually less variation, you see? And more of the variation comes from jumps. So like, look at Argentina.
When you have a fat tail, you start to get into a power law.
Sorry?
When you have the fat tail, it could be a power law.
No, but one of the characteristic of a fat tail is not that there's a fat tail event, because often you don't see it, that there's no volatility outside the fat tail event. You see, and mathematically, you showed it mathematically in that paper, and published, of course, in the same journal, all right, what I call it elements of quantitative finance, what people, you know, don't understand about tail. It was four mistakes, but it was very interesting because then I caught a risk manager who didn't understand risk, that the risk isn't in variation effectively when you shift to the, you know, fat-tailed. In other words, it's not so much volatility. The VIX doesn't represent fat-tailedness. It represents variation. And usually to build, like I used to build fat-tailed trades, I would sell volatility and buy the tails and only be harmed by medium volatility. Not very fat-tailed volatility, which is what people couldn't understand what my business was. Tell them, I don't want medium volatility. I want no volatility or maximal volatility, right? So to really map it into businesses that have, typically, you can tell, actually, that businesses that are short the tail tend to have steady income. And businesses that are long the tail tend to have erratic, highly variable, and typically not good outside of tail events. And these are the businesses, effectively, that have produced what we have in the world, okay? Now scientific discovery is a fat-tailed event. It's hunting for out-of-the-money options. They're on cost. I mean, we spend a lot of money trying, all right? Pharma is the biggest fat-tail as an industry. You look how much money they're in. What's their business? Their business is keep trying. You have cost of trying. We have small losses. Out-of-the-money option, and you finance it.
So I see. Okay. So what's ruined it a little bit is that the FDA requires more and more money to get a drug through trial, so it's hard to do trial and error.
The cost of trial and error increases, right, visibly under regulation and other environments, and increases also under what happened is that if you're what people don't realize is the return is much more linear to number of trials than to total dollar spent. So, and people now go for blockbuster drugs. So they spend a lot of money in one direction so more prone to error. And,
right.
and they're not, when you hunt for fat tail, a business that understands fat tails very well is publishing, right? Like cinema. And that's a fat tail business. We're not far from my publisher, Random House. Go to the lobby of Random House on Broadway. Mm-hmm. Go to the lobby and walk in. The first time I walked in, I was not yet published, you know, I was a best-selling author, so someone made me wait. You know, they make you wait if you're this, and otherwise you're a best-selling author, then you have a special elevator, you right. see the thing. So when you wait in the lobby, I looked and I said, oh my God, this building likes publishers, or publishers like this building, because they're nothing but publishing houses. Guess what? It turned out to be all belong to the same Bertelsmann.
Right.
Because when you're in a fat tail business, you make your income off of few blockbusters. You got to have thousands of books.
So again, so this is...
So they have like 70, 80 publishing houses, separate publishing houses in the same building.
Right.
So, in the Random House, Crown, Knopf, this, that, things you've never heard of, all right?
Yeah.
And when you have a lot... And when you're in a fat tail business, you need a lot of small trials. You see, making bets on stuff, and once in a while you got a Harry Potter.
Publishers are essentially venture capitalists on books. So
exactly.
But now, so that's a resilient business. It's not necessarily anti-fragile.
No, yet. It is anti-fragile. They like, they're
fat. Let's say a book fails.
Sorry?
If a book fails.
It costs them $5,000. If they do it right, all right, it's like an option. You lost $5,000 if it fails, right. and you make $100 million if it's right.
Right, but if so they don't mind failures, but do the failures make them stronger?
No. My mapping of anti-fragile isn't so much in something makes you stronger, so on, so much the system benefits from mistakes.
Right? Okay.
So, or benefits from randomness, or benefits from other things. All right. Yes. If you try to publish a book, and typically, let me tell you how the system benefits from mistake. You're trying to have a hypertension drug, and you end up with Viagra. Same thing. They try to publish a book on some. Like they did with the Black Swan, they tried to publish a book on they thought a narrowly defined subject by an option trader, okay, whom you can probably rely on having a few, and it turned out from an option trading book, all right, into some global interpretation of history that made them that sold X million. Well, you get the idea. So that was a mistake on their part, you see.
Right.
That was a positive mistake. That was so they can publish a book like Umberto Eco, they think is a scholarly book, and their mistake is that it's a hugely popular topic that sells 50 million copies. You see? It's pretty much like a drug. So you have side effects that you didn't predict, that but whatever you don't predict, that typically helps you. And that's the idea.
So the model itself is strong, because sometimes these small losses could turn into huge. Sometimes the mistakes can turn into huge winners.
Because no mistake will cost, it makes your book
right.
cost you more than you spent for it. It's like a finite premium for an option. So all the mistakes are the upside.
Right.
But if you spend $1 billion for a book, all right, and some people have spent millions and millions on books, all right, the mistake is when you start spending a lot of money on publishing Al Gore, all right, and the thing flops, so you have a big loss, you see, for no upside. That's typically when people go for small bets in highly unpredictable domains and in a field that nobody really understands very well, you have a huge upside. Mm-hmm. Okay, and that's but so you can look at the P&L of people who've done that: movies, pharma,
real estate.
If I walked into The Black Swan when I was writing it, thinking that most money was made in America by innovation and high tech and stuff like that, it turned out to be false. The big bucks were made in America, big fortunes, all right? If you look at the time, I look at net worth of people, the big fortunes were made in real estate. And then I understood why it was a sucker game, because real estate is long volatility for the owner of the house, so you can borrow, and short for the bank, which explained why the banks never made money. And individuals made tons of money on real estate. And real estate was a good business, for these people, because they have a free option.
It's funny, too, like the housing crisis began long before, or not the crisis, but housing was going down for a year and a half before the banks blew up. So housing was handling itself fine, but then the financial crisis happened as a result of
the way they package things. But typically banks are good at giving people free options. I remember manufacturers Hanover went bust because Donald Trump made bad bets. And eventually Donald Trump got rich, all right? But manufacturers Hanover became part of Chemical Bank, became part of now J.P. Morgan, you see. So the mistakes of if a mistake can blow you know, up, you're not a good business. But what's worse is when someone has an asymmetry. My mistakes blow up the bank, not me, you see.
Right.
Or because the way they finance it. And also, and what they did, even had they not done that, when I looked at the risk of Fannie Mae, huge, even without these packages, banks were overexposed to downside of real estate.
So right now in the economy, where do you see the biggest bubbles or risks or fragility?
I don't know. I mean, I make bets, all right? So my bets are out of the money bets, so it's not a predictive bet. I made, after the crisis, I initially made bets on gold, and then I was long gold short S&P, and then ended up long both. Right. And then I ended up getting rid of my gold. And why did I have the S&P? Because I said, okay, flooding money in the system, going to either harm the bonds, help the stocks, or both. So, and then I started getting short bond on, in and out, right? Mm. So I had S&P with a shortage bond position, and it paid off, right? So the quantitative easing with some long real estate, right? It did pay off. And then I... You know, because I said, okay, the only way they're curing the system is by giving free money. So you got to, people free money will go buy. So it worked out fine. And so I'll tell you, because skin in the game, I only look at my thing. And then I bought some euros, right, when Europe was, because people on TV would go and say, oh, Europe, as if it was a catastrophe. It was like Dresden, you know, with a big hole, was smoking like Syria. Pictures of Syria today. And I bought some Europe, or I bought European currency because they weren't engaged in the same thing. And then I got out of it. So now my exposures now, I would say, are minimal to anything now. So given that, it means I don't have a view of anything, but I'm trying to get out of trouble.
It's good sometimes. It's I would say anti-fragile sometimes to minimize. Sometimes.
You want to be in cash. My only risk of being in cash is you miss on... You can have inflation, okay, or you miss on something. So there's risk to be in cash. What I call cash, I have two cash. I have cash that can be invested. And I have what I call numeraire, protect me from inflation, which is a basket. Mm-hmm. And that basket contains some real estate, not much, some stocks, not much. Some. You always have to have something that protects you because... The big tail risk is I work all my life, you know, I have a good life to... things can be harmed by inflation, all right? Or you can have asset price inflation, but not inflation, which is what we have now, all right? Mm-hmm. Which is worse, actually, because you see all the things you wanted to buy running away from you, and then the other things are not. So I have some hedge there, okay? Some agricultural stuff like that, just to say this is hedged for inflation, okay? But I would say I'm monstrously underinvested now with the rest. Mm-hmm.
To the point where you feel bad, like you're an investor at heart.
To the point that I don't look at a screen. You know that you're underinvested when you can go for 2 days without looking at a screen. How many hours you can go without looking at a stock market screen? You see, if I have to look at it with high frequency, it means I'm overinvested. Okay. Mm. And then you become victim to noise and stop losses. If I'm looking at it with, like now, I couldn't care less. And if I'm looking at it, healthily, like I would like to be healthily, it means it was good enough a frequency. Then I'm calibrated. But I've never really been calibrated. I've been moved, I typically go from total indifference to maximum interest.
What about, like, given your ideas on pharma, what about, you know, big pharma has the risk of FDA regulations, but then you have like biotechs, you know, well-funded biotechs.
Okay, no.
Can biotech do more trial
is a very biotech is a very interesting domain. Biotech, particularly that they have they're underestimated by the market because they can have a huge discovery that will change everything. You see, small probability. That's not part of the data. But I'm not involved. It's just too much headaches trying to figure out. It's just, I mean, I have a comfortable life. I don't want to mess it up by having complicated stuff. But sometimes for entertainment, I do trades. And typically, I go with the irrational, which is strange for someone who likes the irrational, because it seems to me that if something is irrational, it means to be a hidden reason behind it. You see? If something, like, for example, when I went into Europe, Europe was very, 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 very steady. And everybody said it's bad news. If the journalists say it's bad news and the stock market is not, I go with the stock market. You see? Or I go with the currency. I go with the element. But I'm not too much in the market. Plus, of course, I have a convex bet on the crash in the stock market.
So
typically, I would say my position would be in the stock market. The way I do it is I'd be long the stock market. I lose money if there's a 10% drawdown. But if there's a 20% drawdown, I make tons.
Because so you buy out-of-the-money puts.
Because I'm always has this kind of out-of-the-money thing. I played it with bonds, but now it's difficult with bonds.
Although, even though there's most likely some sort of bubble in bonds at some point.
Yeah, I don't want to miss it. I don't want to miss it, but to express it with a positive carry is hard. So sometimes you go in and I don't want to think about it. So you go out.
Too complicated.
Yeah, but I have enough gold, you know, in my own thing, and I have enough short bonds in my core, you know, what I call luminaire, that I don't have to worry much about that.
So Black Swan, you're saying, sold very well. Fooled by Randomness is a great book as well that I highly recommend every trader
Fooled by Randomness was read by traders, but not outside. The Black Swan was read outside trading.
Right.
A lot.
And Anti-Fragile, I almost view it as a personal improvement book, like a way of thinking about life as opposed to trading.
It's the one that satisfied me the most in its reaction, because what I always tell people is that there is nonlinearity. You don't want to sell a million copies, because if you sell a million copies, you're going to have 800,000 people reading it, buying it, who shouldn't be buying it.
Well, it's still hard to execute on it. People like their fragile lives because that's the controlled environment. So it's hard for people to say, okay, I'm going to fast randomly like every other week.
Yeah, that's true. But Anti-Fragile is the kind of... No, I mean, I wrote Anti-Fragile not as a book for... I wrote it as you put your soul into a book.
Yeah.
So it is... It's a fourth volume of that inserto, and I put my soul into it. But all the answers in the Black Swan. I also wrote it in a way to be less accessible to the common person. And why voluntarily? Why? Because I don't want to have to the readers. And I don't want to go to conferences where you have all these big names who have bestsellers and be one of them, like in a cattle market. I want to just have my own. I pull back from public image. When you have a big bestseller, you have trauma, and you have also you learn from stuff, and you say, okay, you want to do it once, you don't want to do it all the time. So I did not want to have as big, and I don't want in the future to have any big. I'd rather have a steady, smart readership than crazy people citing it without understanding what it is. Mm. And Anti-Fragile is in that category. Mm. It did. It's like Fooled by Randomness. Fooled by Randomness was almost never bought by people who didn't understand it. Mm. Or didn't get. I mean, not almost never. It was the ratio is very low for Fooled by Randomness. And Fooled by Randomness over time did, I don't know, something, a million some copy. I mean, something worldwide. It did worldwide, in a million some copies. So
and Anti-Fragile, you don't think will...
Anti-Fragile is selling a lot more than Fooled by Randomness, at its stages. But Fooled by Randomness, I want Anti-Fragile. You want books to follow the Lindy effect. I don't care about what they sell today. I care about what they sell in 10 years. You see?
To your point of, if it's still selling in 10 years, it's going to be selling for another 10
years. Fooled by
Randomness
today is 13 years old, 14 years old. 13 years old.
Still sells.
This week, 14 years old. 13 years old. And it's not that it still sells. It's still in print. It's still active. The black swan is, of course, too known as a metaphor that bothers me. Antifragile is similar to fooled by randomness, except that it's a different crowd. It's more difficult than fooled by randomness, much more difficult.
You know, but it got me thinking really just about every area of my life and what was fragile and what wasn't. And not only every area currently, but every area in the past and how the different parts where I made myself antifragile just by instinct because I didn't want to lose anymore.
That's good. Now that I'm thinking about it, there's a test you can do for yourself, all right? If you've had a little bit of disorder and you weren't harmed by it, it means you didn't have enough of it.
If I wasn't harmed by it.
If you weren't harmed by it. Right. If you had something bad happen or something like that, weren't harmed by it, it means you need more of it.
No, I was definitely harmed by it, and then I had to overcome.
Overall, if you weren't harmed by something, then you have... And let me tell you that a lot of people don't understand that something I mentioned just en passant, didn't focus too much on it, in antifragile, is post-traumatic growth. Hmm. That growth comes from trauma. People talk about post-traumatic disorder. The real thing is post-traumatic growth. Hmm.
So if you do grow too much, let's say, from a failure, that might not be a good thing.
No. What I meant is that most people think that... people get trauma from wars, from stuff like that. I was a victim of war. It was horrible, right? And you know, in the Near East, wars are not very pleasant, okay? But I think that I benefit from it. I personally grew from it. So had a psychologist, you know, just to bill X dollar, you know, $100 an hour, would have found a disease, you see. But a lot of people benefited from it. And a generation, a friend, they all did very well. Personally, emotionally, all kind of stuff. So in a way, you grow from disorder,
right?
But there's something important, you know, to when you approach a topic like antifragile, something important. You don't want to ask too much from the topic. Try to apply it, okay? But you should be demanding, but don't ask too much from the topic. In other words, don't try to apply the topic, you know, blindly to a lot of things. But it has enough application. In other words,
it's worth thinking about.
It has enough application. In other words, in biology, in biological system, in stressors, in ecosystem, it has enough application. And it's a beginning, not an end. One thing that pleases me a lot is I'm telling you that I switched life with antifragile. You know, I try to, you know, just do enough of the markets for entertainment, not other things. Mm-hmm. I'm also advisor to my old friends who are continuing the business I was in America. So just do enough activities. But I wanted to be just now become a scholar, you know, retire into pure scholarship. You know,
nine published papers this week.
This year.
A book, Silent Risk.
So I'm doing technical work. There's a technical work. And I'm realizing that in a technical field, I mean, there are good disciplines and bad disciplines. There are disciplines like political science that are totally clueless. And the discipline like physics and complex systems, they're monstrously insightful. You see, and to understand that, you have to know from the inside. But there is a huge appetite for ideas like the ones of antifragile. And I don't want, you know, this is not no longer a book where it belongs to one person. It's you see the development of ideas, and you want to be part of it, filling out, even without citing antifragile, without mentioning it once, you see, citing into this mission. And now what is that thing is really trying to understand how systems function without so we can live in a world in accordance with the way the world is rather than in accordance with the way we'd like it to be. Distributed system, like nature, how to handle nature, how to handle global warming, how to handle all of these. And I'm involved in this. So I'm very, very happy because I started an academic career. And academic doesn't mean teaching. It means writing paper, researching, interacting with researchers, doing things. Which is why I don't think I'm going to write books for the general public anymore after antifragile. I don't think I will. I mean, you know, people may have relapses, but I will be producing a more scientific stuff that has theorems, proofs, and it's actually so much easier to do science.
Where will you release that? Like Silent Risk here. This
Silent
is
Risk is for
book.
Free on the web. It's for free on the web. Anybody can access it. I don't feel like giving it to a publisher for now. And the good thing is that if I find a mistake, I'm going to Singapore.
Change it. It becomes open source in a sense because people can tell
you. No, I change it. I change it. But in other words, I change it and I learned to write in text, so it's formatted the way it is. It comes right instantly. And probably it could be between cover, but I want it to stabilize, you know, at the level, stabilize in the sense that I keep changing. You know, I wake up, I change, introduce the topic, and Silent Risk. Silent Risk is really the backup of all my other books with the mathematical backing. And it's very strange. I noticed that there's something we're doing with this paper. Okay, I noticed this paper, we use a lot of English, all right? And then at the end, we have math, proof, theorem, this proof. Okay, so I noticed nobody reads the math. Nobody reads the math.
But if it's there, people feel comfortable.
But they feel comfortable with what I'm saying here without harassing me. What do you mean by this? Mm. They feel comfortable. They leave you alone. Mm. I'm doing the same thing with the inserto by giving all this mass. And I discovered, you know, and quite, you know, quite surprising that nobody knew, you see, nobody knew that I did math for a living. So this is mathematical stuff.
They must not have read dynamic hedging.
Or I mean, people said, "Oh, the black swan," and it's very strange because there's the same idea I express in math. People take it seriously, although it's harder to understand. Or they complain that it's dense, but it's harder to understand. But then you express it in words, they don't take it seriously, although it's easier to understand. So if people, but so this is what makes scientific writing easy because you don't have any inhibition about how deep you want to go. Nobody's going to complain. That's very strange, right? But the other thing that makes it also easy is because when I put a book out, I'm afraid of being misunderstood and having to explain stuff. When you put science out, it is self-standing in the sense that it's very hard to misunderstand an equation, right? Mm. You may misunderstand the application and stuff. You're outside the verbalistic aspect. And it's quite liberating. And also what's even more interesting is that I know that if I make a mistake, it would be caught faster. Because the beauty of mathematics isn't that it helps us get, is that if someone expresses himself mathematically, he gave you a tool, right, to critique him. In other words, it's made it clear. I made my statements clear on here, so you can see very clearly what I'm saying. If you find a mistake, you can spot it. So this is why it's more open to investigation for others to say, hey, you know, you made a mistake here. So Silent Risk has one part. One part is about risk and probability, and the second part about how systems like disorder and how city-states do better and stuff like that. And Silent Risk, part two, make it second volume. And it's very interesting because once I put it mathematically there, now suddenly a lot of people started reading this, Anti-Fragile. And without having the need to go to the mass, because they've seen the mass, they've just glanced at it, they saw a couple of graphs, they come back, and now they're interested in Anti-Fragile. This is why there have been no scientific criticism of Anti-Fragile. 100% of the scientists who've looked at Anti-Fragile found it positive. They wouldn't have done that if I didn't supply him with a mathematical backup.
Well, I definitely look forward to checking out Silent Risk, and I know you say you don't want millions of people to read and understand Anti-Fragile, but I really, it's a life-changing book. I really think it's a great book.
Oh, thank you very much. Thanks a lot. It was very pleasant.
Yeah, I'm glad you came on the show. And I wish I had followed up on my email with you in 2002. I think I had coffee with the wrong people. So
they blew up in 2008 or no, 2007, 2008?
Yeah, both times, several
both times. Okay, that's fine. All right, yeah, that won't happen to you. All right. Okay.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Great. Thanks a lot.